the lab on Friday, even though it's a study day. The lab will be open. Thursday, too? Yeah, sure. If you want to go to the lab on Thursday or Friday, catch up a little bit. Great idea.
Will there be any tutors in
there? There will be no tutors available.
But Saturday will be?
Saturday, yeah, for sure. You should be completing bone in the lab. Drawing. Should be done with bone. And today our main task, maybe I didn't indicate that to you, but the main task today is muscle. We have to finish a little bit on bone first. I'm not sure we'll get to nerve today. We'll talk about nerve next week. Neural tissue. Okay, are we ready? We looked at a comparison between bone that had all its mineral removed, decalcified, so that all the material in here is primarily organic material. And we compared that with a preparation where the only substance that makes this image is mineral. So here the organic material is present, and over here all the organic material is removed, and therefore these black holes representing the location of the bone lamellae, don't contain any cells because all the organic material is gone. The lacuna appears black there. The lacuna here, sort of a lacuna there, may appear white. We saw an osteoprogenitor cell. We used the term for the first time when we looked at this. OP, osteoprogenitor cell. We'll come back to that here in a second when we look at how bone is formed. We also then compared ground bone with spongy bone, compact bone here and spongy bone there. This spongy bone, you might say, is fully formed and not in the process of engaging in new bone formation. And the way I know that is because when I look at the surface of the bony spicules or trabecula, when I look at the bony trabeculae, I don't see any osteoblasts on the surface. Therefore, that tells me there's no bone being made at this particular time. Now, if parathyroid hormone were to be secreted in increased amounts, then we'd see activity here, including bone being reabsorbed by what cell? What cell reabsorbs bone? Osteoclast. Don't see any osteoclast. Don't see any osteoblast. So it's pretty quiet bone. We'll look at some active bone here in a second. I think we left off right here. Talking about the fact that spongy bones found more in the epiphyses. And then we asked the question, what's the origin of the epiphyseal plate? And what's the origin, and we can also ask the question, what's the origin of articular cartilage? And even though you can't see it very well, there is a little piece of skeleton here made of hyaline cartilage. And so epiphyseal plate and articular cartilage are both derived from the original cartilage that formed this piece that you can't see right there. And then we talked about the fact that our skeleton, which begins to ossify about 8 weeks of pregnancy, and then bones ossify, or the skeleton ossifies, over the next few weeks. The long bones, the appendicular skeleton, I think it's called, gross anatomy, the arms and legs, the appendages, form mostly from cartilage, hyaline cartilage, which transforms then That's in the process you see here where blood vessels enter the diaphysis, and then cartilage becomes calcified, and then osteoblasts begin to appear. And this first bone is spongy, and later on it can become compact bone. So this articular cartilage here and the hyaline cartilage there are all derived from the original hyaline cartilage skeleton. We'll come back to that. Let's look at a new slide here. We introduced the term osteoprogenitor cells, and we have them in us now, even though they're more prevalent in the fetus. These osteoprogenitor cells would be stem cells. We don't have too many of them, but we have some, and they're going to be located in habergeon canals, mainly. During development of our skeleton in embryonic and fetal life, that's when we see most of these, and they are able, and to a small degree in you and I, they are able to become bone-forming cells. Question is, what other cells in connective tissue are like osteoblasts? Or what other cells in connective tissue do similar things? Similar things as osteoblasts, except these cells I'm thinking of don't form hydroxyapatite crystals. What cells are we talking about? Fibroblasts. Yeah. Anything with a blast on the end, you can bet your bottom dollar that they're similar. That's another one of my mother's things. You can bet are making fibers and matrix. Fibroblasts, chondroblasts, osteoblasts. Here's another one. Odontoblast. What's an odontoblast made? Dentin in the teeth, right? The dentin, not the enamel, but the dentin. And they're all really closely related cousins. Fibroblasts don't form or don't cause calcification like odontoblasts do. So there's a slight difference between them. But all of them are from the same family, and they make collagen fibers, and they make extracellular ground substance. What type of collagen, 1, 2, 3, 4, what type of collagen is made by osteoblasts? Well, let me rephrase it. Let me ask you differently. What type of collagen is made by chondroblasts?
2.
Cartilage has type 2 collagen, remember? Cartilage has type 2 collagen. What kind of type of collagen is made by osteoblasts? 1. Type 1 collagen. Just like most of our body is type 1 collagen, including bone and skin. Including bone and skin. But cartilage doesn't make type 1. Chondroblasts have a little different, slightly different function. Definition of osteoblasts, that's simple. Bone matrix forming cells. Osteoblasts have very few long processes. They're very short. And the osteoblasts on spongy bone line up. Here's the surface of the bone. The osteoblasts on spongy bone line up almost like an epithelium on the surface of the bone, and they have some contact, like an epithelium, by some processes. But generally, they don't have very long processes.
Did you just say long and short in the same sentence, or is that just made by grace?
I'm sorry, maybe I did. Generally, these osteoblasts do not have long processes. They have some. The reason why we're saying this is because when they differentiate into the osteocyte, they develop this long arm long process, like a neuron almost, having an axon. And those long processes, which are present here, those long processes run through each canaliculus. All those little black lines you saw when you looked at the ground bone, and we'll see some more here in a second.
Wait, so that's the osteocyte has the long arm.
Osteocyte has long arm. This one, no, no. No, they have to grow that long arm. Do osteoblasts live in lacunae?
No.
They don't live in lacunae. They live on the surface of the bone. They're on the outside of the building. They're the people that pick it on the outside with these little pickets there. They're not allowed inside the federal building. They're not allowed in the building. Well, they're not. It could be, but once they get in the building, they get trapped, as we'll see. So here's some active spongy bone. And we know it's active because, as you saw in lab, or maybe we'll see in lab, the surface of the bone is loaded with osteoblasts that almost look like an epithelium. They're in single file, and they're busy making new bone, and the newest bone, labeled OT here, the newest bone is not fully completed yet. There's collagen there, but there's not much else, and that's called osteoid. That's the new bone. We'll run across osteoid again later in pathology when we talk about various bone diseases, where there's too much osteoid, too little osteoid, and these sort of things. It appears in your specimen as a very pale white area between the fully formed bone and the osteoblast layer. What's OCL stand for over here? Osteoclast. We used to have some really good slides of this. There were some osteoclasts in your lab preparations, but I'm not very happy with what we have there. What's important for you is to know that these cells are eating away, causing bone destruction wherever they're placed. And this little arrow here indicates the edge of the bone that's being resorbed. The edge of the bone is being resorbed by the acid from the osteoclast and the enzymes from the osteoclast. We'll look at their function in a little more detail later. Oftentimes, in spongy bone, we'll see, when it's active, we'll see osteoclasts resorbing bone on one surface, and we'll see osteoblasts making bone on the other surface. When our skull bones form, the little baby's head is about this big, and then eventually the head's that big. Well, the brain grows, even though the number of neurons don't increase, the brain still grows, and so the skull's got to get bigger than the baby. The way this happens is that the inside of the bone of the skull is eaten away. So if we have a skull bone and a little baby here, like this, the brain's up here, and the hair's up here, the osteoclasts eat away at the bone here. And osteoblasts add on to the bone here. What happens if you eat away this bone and add on this bone, and then eat away this surface and add on this surface? What happens to the skull? It's bigger. And this is the best example of this phenomenon, even though it also occurs in all of us all the time. All the time, wherever there is osteoclast and osteoblast activity. When you put braces on the teeth, when you put braces on the teeth, you expect the teeth to move. Well, how's this going to happen? The bone has to be reabsorbed by osteoclast at one point, and osteoblasts have to to make a new bone on the other side. So if the tooth is here, and you want the tooth here, you got to move the bone socket. You don't yank the tooth over, you put tension on the tooth, and bone gets reabsorbed by osteoclast because of the tension, and pretty soon the socket, oh, there's the tooth here, and here's the socket. The socket's over here now. Well, it brought the tooth with it. And this is the process there of that, those braces in action. What are these cells in here called? What do you call those? Here they're labeled for you, OC. What are they called?
Osteocytes.
What do they live in? What do you call a cell in cartilage living in a lacuna? What do you call a cell living in a lacuna in cartilage? Chondrocytes. Osteocytes. Would you call that an osteoblast? No. It's the same cell, however, except now it's living in a room, and so that cell must have been afraid of a stalker because the cell changed its name. It changed its name from osteoblast to osteocyte. Just like you drive on Bothell Way, and all of a sudden you're on Lake City Way. What happened here? Same street, different name. Same cell, different name. Except this cell has developed some other characteristics. It's not nearly as active anymore. This is loose connective tissue out here. This is really hard stuff there. A realer connective tissue. And sometimes it'll be bone marrow, red bone marrow, and sometimes it'll be fatty bone marrow.
Process you described with the braces, with the tooth being reformed, doesn't that also happen when you break a bone?
When you break a bone, there's the last slide in your question on this section. It kind of highlights that point, but we're not going to get to it. It turns out that when a bone breaks, a cartilage strut, hyaline cartilage strut, is made first, and then that hyaline cartilage has to be replaced by bone. And then there's some remodeling going on when the bone... Yeah, absolutely. I remember I've seen x-rays where the surgeon or the physician has set the bone, and you expect the broken bone here to be set this way. Well, I've seen x-rays where after the setting it's right here, and it says, boy, that's never going to work. One piece of the bone's here, one's here, and it doesn't line up. Well, get them 10 weeks, and little kid, pretty soon it's right there, where it's supposed to be. So you can be kind of casual in setting a bone in a young kid because it all takes care of itself by this process here anyway. Now you and me, if we break a bone, that's a different story. We're not quite as good at that. Well, let's look at that osteoclast sitting there. Let's go back and check it out. And there it is there, sitting there. In a little, God, I hate all this vocabulary. Sitting in a little slip called Howe Ship's Lacuna. That little notch there is called Howe Ship's Lacuna, and the osteoclast sitting there munching away like little Pac-Man in that little notch there. So let's look at what this cell can
do. Can we go back to the previous slide just for a moment?
What's that?
Can we go to the previous slide just for a moment? I had a question on location of the
Howe Ship's Lacuna. Howe Ship's Lacuna is this little notch right there.
Okay.
Howe Ship's Lacuna is like Elliott Bay in Seattle. Big old notch in the landmass there. And that's it right there. And it doesn't show Howe Ship's Lacuna here, but it does show the function of osteoclasts. They're big cells. They have multiple nuclei, obviously far more than just two nuclei. The artist here has drawn two nuclei in the same cell. We might see 6 to 8 nuclei. And so that makes us wonder, where they came from and how they developed with all this nuclear mass in it. And they are, since they are eaters, and since they are big eaters, we could call them what?
Macrophages.
They're gigantic macrophages. And that tells us the origin, because all macrophages come from a blood cell called monocytes. Great. A monocyte. All macrophages come from monocytes. So these cells originate from the bloodstream. And when it's necessary for bone to reabsorb, the monocytes merge together. They pool their cytoplasm, they pool their nuclei, and those 6 to 8 monocytes now become one giant macrophage. That's really unusual in human biology for that to happen. So, the question is, what turns these cells on? What makes them excited? What's the answer? What's going to make your bone reabsorb and pour calcium into the bloodstream over there? Parathyroid hormone, EPH, good. Would calcitonin do that?
No.
Parathyroid hormone, somehow or another, from our four little glands in our neck here, somehow turns on this cell, probably also is recruiting them from the bloodstream. We don't know that story completely, but it certainly is activating these cells. The problem that we have is that there are no receptors in the cell membrane in osteoclasts for parathyroid hormone. Hormones of all types need receptors. They need either cell membrane receptors or cytoplasmic receptors. So a long time ago it was envisioned that there must be a cell membrane receptor that links up with this protein hormone here, parathyroid hormone, and of course, there is none. So how do they work then?
So does the parathyroid hormone stimulate the membrane, or does it cause the monocytes to form into the osteoclast?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. We don't know the signal for the formation of the osteoclast. It's probably related to, and it is directly related to elevated parathyroid hormone in the bloodstream, but we don't know the steps. But however, we do know the steps on how parathyroid hormone activates the cell. Parathyroid hormone has receptors on osteoblasts. BTH binds to our osteoblasts. That doesn't make any sense. Until they discovered that osteoblasts secrete chemicals called cytokines. Interleukin-1 is one of them. Osteoblasts, when activated by parathyroid hormone, secrete these cytokines, interleukin-1, which we know partially recruits monocytes from the blood, but more importantly, activates the osteoclasts to start working. Two steps, isn't it? Step one, parathyroid hormone binds to the osteoblasts. Step number two, osteoblasts secrete interleukin-1. Step three, interleukin-1 binds to osteoclasts, and away we go. Much. Three steps.
You must have missed something how it says step one for thyroid hormone binds to the osteoblast, but if there's no receptor, how does it do that?
It there's no receptor on the osteoclast. This is the osteoclast. There are receptors on the osteoblast. Not on the osteoclast. That's the point. I'm glad you brought it up because that's a very important point.
So does that also signal the osteoblast to start building?
Well, we don't know that for sure. That's a reasonable question. The question is, does interleukin-1 activate the osteoblasts as well to make new bone? We don't know for sure. But that's a reasonable supposition. So, osteoblasts have receptors for estrogen. And when estrogen binds to osteoblasts, not the clasp, when the estrogen binds to the osteoblasts, it inhibits the production of interleukin-1. When estrogen binds to the osteoblasts, it stops the production of interleukin-1. So what happens to the osteoclast then? Doesn't work. How's the bone in the female then? Quite strong then, because it's not being eaten away. What happens to postmenopausal women? What happens in postmenopausal women where this is no longer present in sufficient amounts? What happens with interleukin-1? Not inhibited anymore, and it just pours out, and the osteoclasts start eating away the bone, and they develop osteoporosis.
Is there any pattern female bones that reflects the cycling of estrogen?
In premenopausal women, you're saying?
Yeah.
In premenopausal women. Yes, because of the ovarian cycle and the endometrial cycle and the pituitary cycle. Yes, there is cycling in bone as well. But men have estrogen as well.
So then, for men, because the women start losing bone density after the estrogen is not being produced as much, do men in general have thinner bones? And maybe why is it that it seems that women are more prone to osteoporosis?
Yeah. Well, one explanation, which isn't adequate enough in my mind, is that that strong bones, big bones, are not just caused by osteoclast inhibition. Osteoclast activity would weaken the bone. So what about anyone with strong bones? Well, it's not just due to estrogen levels, it's due to how much tension is on the bone by muscle contraction. So there's lots of signals to bone, lots of signals to osteoclasts, other than just estrogen. So if men, obviously this is not the case anymore, but if men work in hard labor, and testosterone is a factor as well, or anybody, male or female, that has heavy-duty muscular contractions on bone, the bone gets bigger. The Russians place electrodes on the bone, stimulating bone growth. Or you can go to a gym and work out and have stronger, healthier bones, even in maybe a relative deficiency of estrogen.
This might not be
appropriate
for Christian belief class, but if you had a menopausal female as your patient, and she was on, bone density medications, help increase her bone density. What would be, a natural alternative besides getting her into, the gym and having her increase her?
I wish I knew the basic differences in side effects between animal-derived estrogen and plant-derived estrogen. But in my mind, if you gave a woman phytoestrogens derived from plants, you wouldn't have the same contraindications. And you'd have to talk to somebody that's knowledgeable in naturopathic medicine, because I don't know diddly about naturopathic medicine.
So, maybe some type of natural hormone replacement?
Natural hormone replacement, in other words, phytoestrogens and plant-derived estrogens make a lot of sense to me.
And
And the gymnasium work, too, of course. Certainly anything that they can do to put some sort of tension on the bone.
Because the bone density does seem to be really bad for people. But, you know, it's like, do I worry about hip fracture or do I, take...
Yeah, it's a balancing act, isn't it? Do you give the postmenopausal female estrogen and run the risk of breast cancer and uterine cancer, or do you not prescribe estrogen and run the risk of a hip fracture or any kind of fracture? But phytoestrogens sound good, and check with the naturopath and see what they would do. I think phytoestrogens would be good.
Like to add something? I don't think you should assume that all postmenopausal women will develop osteoporosis.
That's the other thing, yes.
No, I agree. I was just saying for a patient that came in that was on.
Right. No, I'm not saying you. I'm just saying I get the feeling.
No, right.
But also another thing that's prescribed is calcium for women who may postmenopausal women. But doesn't it also depend on the amount of calcium the woman has taken throughout her, has been getting throughout her life, and how much is stored?
See, that's an excellent thought, really excellent thought. It turns out that calcium levels in postmenopausal osteoporotic women is irrelevant. Because a postmenopausal woman with osteoporosis may have normal serum calcium levels. They may have low, they may have high, and it doesn't seem to matter. Because the osteoclasts are eating away at the bone, and we've got to shut them off. They're eating away at the bone at a higher level than the osteoblasts are making it. So the osteoclasts here, down here, and Hauschild-Thakuna, double duty. The osteoblasts, single duty. And so there's a total decrease in bone mass. Now, what does that mean? In osteoporosis, there's a decrease in the matrix, the organic matrix. And the calcium, too, is removed, because when the bone is removed, two phases are removed. The mineral, containing calcium, and the ground substance, the collagen fiber. You can give calcium until you're blue in the face, and you're never going to regrow that collagen with calcium. So it's a dilemma, isn't it?
Didn't you say yesterday that calcium doesn't make strong bones? It's just like taking a supplement for calcium would just be so that you're not taking calcium from your bone storage.
Right? So yeah, if you looked at bony spicules in a premenopausal woman that does not have osteoporosis, and you looked at the same bony spicule in a postmenopausal woman that has osteoporosis, it's pretty simple. The bone mass is less, which makes that a weaker bone. Let's go on. Let's save this for pathology. It's interesting, really is, but we're not getting to muscle here. So let's look at this diagram, which helps us understand what the osteoclast is doing. And there's two things that are important. Number one is that there is an enzyme right where that arrow is. Remember biochemistry? Well, maybe you're working on it right now. But there's an enzyme right here called carbonic anhydrase, CA. More important term to learn than Hauschild-Thakuna. Very much more important term. We'll abbreviate it, however, most of the time. Carbonic anhydrase. This enzyme is found in at least three important cells that we have. One of those cells is the osteoclast. One of those cells is a red blood cell, and the other one is the parietal cell in our stomach that's producing acid. And it's because of the carbonic anhydrates that our stomach cell, the parietal cell, it's because of the carbonic anhydrates that this acid is formed relatively quickly. Now, what about in the osteoclast? Well, where do you think this carbon dioxide came from inside the osteoclast? It's the same carbon dioxide that our body cells produce all the time. Metabolism of glucose. C6H12O6. Glucose. Are you studying this in biochemistry yet? Glucose. How many carbon dioxide molecules are derived from the complete metabolism of glucose? How do you figure it out? You count the number of carbon. How many carbon dioxide molecules then? Six carbon dioxide molecules. And carbon dioxide molecules thus are produced in all cells that metabolize glucose for energy, which is about all of our cells, huh? Even red blood cells. So there are carbon dioxide everywhere, and when carbon dioxide meets water in the presence of carbonic anhydrates, it rapidly converts to hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. That reaction is occurring in red blood cells all the time, and we would not survive without that reaction. Parietal cells in the stomach all the time. And what does this hydrogen ion do that's building up in high concentrations in osteoclasts? What's that going to do to the bone? What do hydrogen ions mean to you in excess? Acid. How's the pH of an osteoclast? High or low? pH high is alkaline. pH low is acid. pH of 2 or 3 is in the pH of your stomach. Acid. pH 8 is in your intestine, high. So if pH is low, the acid environment's low, what's that acid doing to our bones? You got two things to think about. Is it causing removal of collagen, or is it causing the removal of the mineral, do you think? The mineral. It's removing the mineral from bone. This acid pump. Constantly pumping out acid into Hauschild's lacuna and removing the mineral. So how are we going to remove the collagen? Well, it's a monocyte. It's a macrophage. And so it's got lysosomes with lots of enzymes, that hydrolases, enzymes that can digest almost any organic substance. And the osteoclast releases lysosomal enzymes into the interface between the bone and the cell, and those enzymes digest all the organic matrix of the bone. So we have enzymes from lysosomes, and we have a chemical reaction with carbonic anhydrase that produces acid to remove the mineral. So that is something that is very important, and you need to somehow or another develop some little trick or mechanism or total enthusiasm about the subject. Remember this and carry it on with you to the rest of the curriculum. Very important subject, especially this subject right there. Structure of the osteon. We've looked at the osteon and we've talked about it a little bit, so this is kind of review now. We're talking about compact bone. Yes. Right, so I can think of an enzyme. I can think of an enzyme in macrophages called collagenase. So what would it dissolve? That lysosomal enzyme collagenase, what would it dissolve? Collagen. Right. Each one of them has a name with an ace on the end. An ace. polygenes. Do aversion canals interconnect with one another from one osteon to the other? What do you think about that? There's a aversion canals running longitudinally of the bone. Do they connect with one another side by side? Yes. Do you remember the name of that connection? Volkmann's canal. Right. Good. We haven't got it down yet. We're working on it. These lamellae are the growth rings. Remember the tree trunk? The growth rings in the tree trunk? These are the growth rings. And these growth rings have lacunae for osteocytes. And the osteocytes located normally in that lacuna. And then from the lacunae, we will see these little channels called canaliculi. And in ground bone, they look black, don't they? Canaliculi are a very important subject here in the histology of bone. The question is, and I would ask on an exam, very, very definitely ask on an exam, is what's found in bone canaliculi? And what would your answer be? Osteocyte process. The osteocytes are touching one another from adjacent lamellae. The inner lamellae cell and the outer lamellae cell, or the next adjacent lamellae, they'll touch each other by running an arm through the canaliculus. Here's the canaliculus. That's a little passageway through the bone. This is all bone here. Solid, hard bone. And here's the osteocyte process running through the canaliculus, touching another osteocyte process and forming a little kiss there called a gap junction. If there's a gap junction between adjacent osteocyte processes, then what do you think that gap junction is there for? Communication, yes. What's the function of gap junctions? Communication. What's the function of tight junctions? Adherence and connection and welding together. Gap junctions are there for communication. And so the osteocyte process, osteocytes found the lacuna, and a process extends like an octopus arm, leg, octopus, or the arms or legs, octopus legs through the canaliculi.
What are the cells communicating?
Yeah, they're sending a signal somehow or another that has to do with nutrition levels, I guess. We're not quite sure. There's a lot of ions that are passing through that are producing an electrical potential on the surface of osteocytes deep in all the various lacuna. So it's apparently important in maintaining adequate electrical potentials on the surface of the cell.
So just going back to what's located in the lacunae, is that the canaliculi and the osteocytes? Or?
The only thing that's in the lacuna is the osteocyte body.
Okay.
The body of the squid or the octopus. What's found in the canaliculi? The arms of the octopus or the squid. Cement line is the outer region of the osteon, the outer line of the osteon, where there's less collagen. Less collagen there in the cement line. The outer line of the osteon, the outer boundary of the osteon. So there's the aversion canal, there's the lamellae, there's the lamellae, there's the lamellae. And the outer lamellae has a very much denser region. The outermost osteonal ring has a region called cement line. I'll show you a picture of it. There's the cement line on the outer edge of the osteon, containing less collagen. Here is the aversion canal. In life, would contain a capillary, and some osteoblasts could appear there, could have some osteoprogenitor cells, could even have an osteoclast appearing right in there. And the lacunae are shown in black. Of course, this is a drawing made from ground bone, so therefore this lacuna would be empty now, and that would contain the body of the osteocyte. And the osteocyte arms, legs, would run through these canals called the canaliculi. And so here's an osteocyte body. There's another osteocyte body. And they have long processes like spider legs, you might say, running through these canaliculi here. And you can see that this cell and that cell are touching one another right there. And there's gap junctions, communicating junctions between them. A little higher mag of the canaliculi. This body here sits in that space, and its arms run through the canaliculus. This cell, this lacuna has another cell here, and it has a little arm running through there, and they communicate right there. What else is found in the canaliculus? That's absolutely essential to the story. Food, nutrients, oxygen, which came from here. Now, remember, there's no capillaries in out here. The last blood vessel is right there. So how is Pluto going to get any sunlight? Well, it has to come from here. And the nutrients pass through the canaliculi that all kind of connect with one another, so the cells in the outer fringes, well, all these lacunae rely on the canaliculi and the blood vessel. Same sort of thing, nothing new here, same as this. There's that nucleus, electron microscope now. There's the nucleus of the osteocyte. Here's the edge of the lacuna. The edge of the lacuna here. This is hard bone. This is part of a lamella here. This is really hard, mineralized collagen mineral. And there's the osteocyte process, the cytoplasmic arm running through the canaliculus. And where's the edge of the canaliculus? Well, the edge of the canaliculus is here, and there, and right here. Here's the canaliculus.
Okay, so that's just the...
And there's the process. Canaliculus is the passageway through the bone, like an underground tunnel, but there's the Carlsbad Cavern, canaliculus, and here's you walking through the canaliculus. And that's shown beautifully, I think, right here. Right there, where the canaliculus, I outlined it's the paper there, I outlined it paper in red, and there's the cytoplasmic process right there.
So is that a specific type of gap junction? You were using the word gap junction?
Yeah, there's only one kind of gap junction, and that's the one with the little cylinders that allow ions and molecules to pass through.
But this functions in the same way?
Yep.
So it's
communicating passage of ions.
The cement
hive?
No, the
lamella. Lamella? Oh, okay. There's a lamella.
Okay, so it's the ring.
A lamella. The rings are the lamellae. Lamellae is a word, a fancy word that means layer, but in this case it means ring.
And then if you go back, those little hair-like projections, that's the canaliculi.
Do what now?
All of those little hair-like projections between lamellae.
They are holes in the bony lamellae.
So that is the canaliculi.
The caniculus is not labeled there. Look at that, the caniculus. Yeah, the caniculi are these little tubes, these little canals running through the lamella.
Thank you. I thought that they were labeled lamella.
Yeah. Oh, I see. see the problem. Yeah, it looks like that canalicula is labeled the millimeter. Too bad.
Yeah.
No question, just relaxing. Any other comment? Okay, good. Good. That's an outstanding, that took a lot of effort to get to make this preparation here. And there's another canaliculus up there, and you can see a little process running through it. Bone development. So, the last subject, and we'll get to this subject, and then we'll take a break. We'll start on muscle in the second hour. There are two categories of bone formation. Yeah, we have some bones in our body where the bone forms directly from mesenchyme. And we have other bones, mostly the long bones of our arms and legs, which are formed first in hyaline cartilage. The bones that form by membrane bone formation do not develop from hyaline cartilage. They develop from this embryonic mesenchyme. And those bones are generally the flat bones of your skull. Frontal bone, parietal bone, mandible, maxillary bones are flat bones. Plus the clavicle. Your clavicle is not laid down in hyaline cartilage first. Almost everything else is. The embryonic skeleton, fetal skeleton, is mostly cartilage, but the bones of the skull and the clavicle, no. They don't have the same formation. And so what happens in intermembranous or membrane bone formation is that the mesenchymal cells that are found in the early embryo are derived, as you remember from your notes, although you maybe don't, from mesoderm, one of the layers of the embryo. Mesenchyme forms from from mesoderm, and that mesenchyme is destined to form all of our connective tissue. Now, in the skull region, these mesenchyme cells, some of them differentiate into bone-forming cells, and some into other kinds of cells, like muscle. But when bone-forming cells appear, then they begin to differentiate into osteoblasts and start making bone around vascularized areas. So blood vessels have to be present, otherwise the bone's not going to form. And bone begins to form around the blood vessels. The first bone formed is osteoid. It's got a lot of it doesn't have the normal proportions of collagen and ground substance. And these cells now that are making bone are now called osteoblasts, and they secrete collagen, they secrete ground substance. And at first, it's not mineralized, and that's what osteoid is, really. Yeah, the main thing about osteoid is that it's right next to the osteoblast, and it's not mineralized yet, and it appears very white and pale in your preparations in the lab. So that's probably the key issue there in the difference between osteoid and mature bone. Eventually, mineralization occurs, and what is necessary for calcification to occur? Well, the osteoblasts, we know they're going to mineralize their environment when they produce alkaline phosphatase. Alkaline phosphatase is an enzyme that osteoblasts release when they are starting to mineralize bone, calcify bone. And there's an important part of the name is right there. And the calcium and phosphates, calcium and phosphates don't combine as a crystalline, as a hydroxyapatite crystal until alkaline phosphatase alters the nature of the phosphate molecule. The details aren't exactly known, but the phosphatase alters the phosphate, and that allows the calcium phosphate to interact to form a mineral now in bone. When bone is being actively formed by osteoblasts, then we know that there's a site of active bone formation. How might this be used clinically? Well, a man has prostate cancer, and prostate's removed. And hopefully it's early enough. But prostate cancer spreads to bone. And so the prostate's removed from our patient. And 6 months later, you got to go in for a checkup. And go in 6 months later, and everything's fine. And go in 12 months later, and the blood test shows elevated alkaline phosphatase in the bloodstream. What happened? What's your clinical diagnosis? Well, alkaline phosphatase is elevated in the blood. There must be some place in the body where osteoblasts are actively making bone. And maybe they're making bone to repair an injury to bone. And what might cause injury to bone in our prostate cancer patient? The metastasis of cancer cells to bone. You got this irritation and breakdown of bone from the growing prostate cell. Isn't that sad? The prostate isn't even present in the body anymore because it was removed 12 months earlier. But the blood test 12 months later shows alkaline phosphatase elevation in the blood, which tells you, as a physician, that cancer of the prostate had already spread to bone before the prostate was removed.
Is that PSA levels or what
is PSA? PSA is prostate-specific antigen, which is a different prostate specific antigen, it's a different story. You could use it the same way. If prostate-specific antigen is elevated, that generally means that there's probably too many prostate cells. If you remove the prostate, and there's no prostate now surgically, and then 12 months later the PSA levels are elevated, you know the prostate cells are growing somewhere else. But you don't know they're in bone. The only way you know them would be in bone is because this bone-forming enzyme is elevated in the blood.
Yeah, and in this particular,
yes, in this particular, in this part of the curriculum, in this particular medical school, we call the process healing. And so what's happening is the bone is healing from the cancer cells that have been growing in the bone and eroding the bone. And you find elevated calcium levels in the blood as well because the bone has eroded, even though osteoclasts weren't responsible for that. I guess what I'm trying to emphasize is I'm not going to test you on this. I'm just trying to tell you that this stuff we're talking about becomes extremely important in your medical practice. And you think, oh, it's just histology, you know? And I don't want to have a microscope on my desk at work anyway. But the problem is it's the subject matter that we're talking about rather than the microscope or the laboratory. So we need alkaline phosphatase and a whole lot more. If you want to read the section on mineralization, you'll find that the authors seem pretty glib about it. But the fact of the matter is we don't really know the molecular events that occur in mineralization of bone. Well, membrane bone is primarily spongy bone in the bones of the skull, but there's some compact bone there as well. And in Gross Anatomy, when you talk about this, you'll talk about the outer table and the inner table of the bone. The outer table and the inner table of a frontal bone is compact bone, but the middle of it is spongy. So there's some compact bone formed in the skull. So here we go. There's the mesenchymal cells, poorly drawn, but okay. We're in the embryo now, about 10 weeks of pregnancy, maybe 11 weeks somewhere. And there in the head region, these mesenchymal cells, stem cells for connective tissue, are now congregating into little islands of cells. And now these are becoming osteoprogenitor cells. These mesenchymal cells over here might go off and form cartilage somewhere else, and fibroblasts somewhere else, and fat cells somewhere else. But these are becoming osteoprogenitor cells. And they will mature as they grow. They will mature into osteoblasts, and then these osteoblasts in the bone of the skull and in the clavicle start to form osteoid right here. Poorly mineralized, and finally gets mineralized. And some of these osteoblasts get trapped by their own making. Some of the osteoblasts get trapped by the osteoid in the matrix, and now we call them osteocytes. They're trapped in the bone.
Just one question. What's the white around the osteoblast?
Forgot. Osteoblast?
Or
osteocyte. That's the lacuna.
Oh, the lacuna.
The lacuna. And the artist here has tried to represent it faithfully, and so that lacuna shouldn't show up if that cell wasn't shrunken. So let's relate this to something closer to home. I mean, it's easy to think about the embryo and the fetus in the mother's womb, but many of you haven't had embryology yet. How many of you have seen a baby and touched the baby's head? What do you feel there? Soft spot. That's happening in the soft spot. Because that soft spot is going to become bone. And so after the baby's born, this process is still going on there. From that fontanelle, the soft spot in the head, this is going on. And later on, we'll see a more mature bone being formed, and at some point in time, maybe an osteoclast would appear with six or seven nuclei. Osteoblasts are making osteoid. There's the non-mineralized bone. Here's the fully mineralized bone. If you haven't seen osteoid in the lab, you better do that before you move on to muscle. This osteoblast here is really going to town, and you see it's beginning to be found deeper and deeper into the bone, and pretty soon it'll be trapped like this one. Trapped is not a good word, but it'll be living in a lacuna. It's not quite there yet, but it's getting deeper and deeper as the matrix is beginning to surround it there. I don't think there's anything more to say about this slide because we want to take a break. But we looked at this before, and the point of this is that this other type of bone formation is the bone formation where a cartilage model appears first. And there's that little cartilage that's my early humerus, maybe, or my early femur, and it's all hyaline cartilage. During endochondral, not intermembranous, but the other form, in endochondral bone formation, this cartilage perichondrium converts to a periosteum. The perichondrium converts to a periosteum, and now we develop a bone collar. A bone collar, like this would all be bone here around the circumference. And that bone collar gets pierced by periosteal buds, gets pierced by blood vessels that go into the interior and start to convert the diaphysis to bone. And pretty soon, a little later on, there's a blood vessel appears up here in the epiphysis, and the secondary ossification center develops. Okay, the rest of this set of slides following this one will not consider for the exam. So there are several slides here which follow, but we're not going to deal with that because we want to take a break and start muscle here in the second hour. So let's take a break. Nothing follows. Nothing follows slide 23. Slide 23. Osteoclasts are not. Osteoclasts don't come rapidly, but osteoclasts are not precise. Cells can respond to things too. But the response to a stimulus, in this case a nerve stimulus, the response is this word contraction. When skeletal muscle cells are stimulated by a nerve, then their response, they're irritable, so they make a response. That response is called contraction. And what happens to the muscle cell, how would you describe contraction of this muscle cell that runs from here to here? Shortens. Simple, isn't it? Contraction means that the cell shortens. So here the biceps cells are long, and when they contract, bicep cells are short. Short contraction means that the cells shorten in length. Now, after they're done contracting, they better have the wherewithal. They better have the wherewithal to return to their resting leg. That's the elastic properties of the muscle. They have the ability to recoil back to their normal leg. So I'm going to contract them, and I'm going to extend them, extensibility, contraction, extension. Extensibility means that after they've shortened, they have the ability to elastically recoil back to their original length. Those are obvious common sense sort of functions of muscle. Here are the three types drawn. In lab next week, not this week, there's no lab this week, remember. Next week, we'll be looking at these muscle cells. We're going to talk a little bit about their differences. You'll be looking at longitudinal sections, like the drawing shows a longitudinal cut, and you'll be looking at cross sections. And identifying muscle in a longitudinal section, like here, and here, and here, is pretty much a piece of cake after you've looked at it for a while. Skeletal muscle, longitudinal, and cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle, vastly different in my mind how they look. But cross sections, meaning that, man, I can recognize those muscle cells when I'm looking at them lengthwise. But when I'm looking at their cut ends, I start tearing my hair out. Because it's not so terribly easy to recognize the skeletal muscle and the cardiac muscle and the smooth muscle if they're cut in cross-sections. Or another way of saying is you need to spend more time looking at cross-sections to feel good about recognizing them. How about in the embryo? Not cardiac muscle or smooth muscle now, we're talking about the skeletal muscle. Why do you think skeletal muscle is appropriately called skeletal muscle? Because it moves the skeleton. Or it attaches to the skeleton. We have some skeletal muscle, however, that has very little attachment to bone. And some of these are in our face. Skeletal muscle, we can smile, frown, pucker up, do all these things. And a lot of those skeletal muscles, some of them, but a lot of them aren't attached to bone. So it's not a perfect world, but the name came from the fact that these muscles generally attach to the skeleton and move bones. So let's draw how they form right on the screen here. So we got an embryonic humerus right there, and over here a radius bone on your arm, two bones in the arm, and maybe they're hyaline cartilage right now. But they're going to become bone. And how does this biceps muscle form? What happens in embryonic development? Well, we have cells that come to be arranged end to end between the developing bones. This isn't going to work yet, because those cells don't make contact. They're not connected. So that little embryo can't move. And these embryonic cells derive from mesoderm, just like mesenchyme does. So these myoblasts come from mesoderm, and they have a nucleus. They have a nucleus there. And they're called myoblasts. They line up in single file. Embryonically, it reminds me of osteoblasts, lining up in single file. A little later, there's that bone. I'm being rather careless now, but there's the bone again. Now the cells grow together and touch one another. Got four cells there, got five cells there. Six cells, they still have a nucleus. But now they develop adhesion points. Let me draw them without the bone here. Now we have these cells that are all lined up, myoblasts. I think I'll draw them better here. They're kind of all in a lined up in a particular direction. Because there's the bone surface here. And there's a bone surface there. We got to have that connection there. There's a nucleus there. And then the next step is that where they touch, the membranes break down. And form what the embryologists call the myotube. It's not really a myotube. Not really a myotube until the place where they touch one another breaks down. And now we have a single pool of cytoplasm surrounded by a single plasma membrane, which represents, in my drawing here, the coalition of four separate myoblasts. It's a myotube. It's a tube of cytoplasm. It's a single cell now. How many nuclei does it have?
Four.
If you take out a single muscle cell in any muscle in your body, there may be as many as, in that single cell, there may be as many as 50 nuclei per millimeter of length. Wow. Now, if I went from the origin to the insertion of the biceps muscle and measured that distance and translated those inches to millimeters, I could multiply those millimeters by 50 to 150, let's say, and I could know the number of nuclei in that one single cell. This myotube now is a single cell. None of those myoblasts in the cell were a control unit. I'm not sure.
So every nucleus is now a single unit. Can you
control three units? Oh, yes, yeah. The question is, what's the function now of a cell that has so many nuclei? Well, the only multinucleated cell we talked about was an osteoclast. And we really don't understand what the role of the multiple nuclei and osteoclasts are. Well, it turns out that these nuclei, all of them, have the exact same DNA. And the exact same DNA, the exact same genes, and each of these nuclei muscle cells can transcribe messenger RNA. And that messenger RNA can leave the nucleus and can go find ribosomes in the skeletal muscle cell, go find the ribosomes in the skeletal muscle cell in their region, and then they can make more contractile protein. And I can turn on my nuclei at will. Single thought. What do I have to do? I have to go to the gym and work out for a month. Well, I can feel those nuclei responding here now. You know, and I'm stressing the nuclei. I'm sending signals to the nuclei, and they're going to transcribe more messenger RNA, and they're going to go out and find the ribosomes, and they're going to make more protein in the cell, and pretty soon that skeletal muscle cell that was that big in my arm now is this big, because those nuclei have, in their area, coded for production of more protein, bigger cells, hypertrophy. The histological structure. I bet you can tell me what the difference is between the term origin and insertion. What's the origin of a muscle? Fixed point. What's the insertion? The movable point. Or another way of saying it is, the origin of a muscle is the attachment of the bone that doesn't move during the contraction. And so, the biceps muscle somehow firmly originating up here as two heads, and its insertion is in the radius which moves when the contraction occurs. How about the rectus femoris muscle? Have you studied that one yet?
Yes.
Okay, where's the origin and insertion of the rectus femoris muscle? Is it up here on the anterior inferioriliac spine, or is it down here in the patella? Where's the origin? Up here. And if that bone remains fixed, then what bone's going to move? The patella? So the leg kicks, huh? Kicks soccer ball. In other words, the rectus femoris can cause extension of the leg. And the rectus femoris contribute to flexion at the hip.
Yes.
Yeah, so which is the origin insertion? And we've just moved the origin, haven't we? So if the origin is that the bone remains fixed. So anyway, generally, the origin is proximal and the insertion is distal, and origin is that part of the muscle that's attached to the bone that doesn't move, or at the joint that doesn't move. Skeletal muscle, is it a tissue or an organ? The biceps muscle, the rectus femoris, the sartorius, the gracilis, is that a tissue or is that an organ? If it's an organ, what qualifies it as an organ? What makes an organ an organ? The presence of all four tissues. Do you think that these muscles we're talking about have all four tissues in them? This is an important, very simple sort of concept. If here's a tendon here and a tendon here, and there's this muscle here from the origin to the insertion, does this muscle that you dissected in the leg in gross anatomy class, does that muscle have all four tissues in it? Absolutely. What's going to hold the skeletal muscle cells together? What's going to keep the muscle cells together in a bundle? Connective tissue. Any epithelium in that muscle?
Yes.
Yeah, in the form of what? Any epithelium in here? In that muscle? Yes, and where would you find that epithelium if you had your pull your microscope out of your back pocket and started looking? Blood vessels, simple squamous epithelium of blood vessels, connective tissue. Would there be any neural tissue in that muscle?
Yes.
Have you traced that neural tissue in lab yet? Have you traced a nerve into the quadriceps muscle? Have you done that? So is there any neural tissue in that muscle?
Yes.
Yeah. It's got all four tissues. Any muscle there? Well, it's mostly muscle. But don't confuse an organ with the muscle tissue. The muscle tissue is just the cells. But the organ, the biceps, has epithelium in it, has connective tissue in it, has neural tissue in it, and has muscle in it. So, therefore, it qualifies as an organ. When somebody says, well, my muscle hurts, you as a student of medicine, the next question is, are you talking about the biceps muscle, or are you talking about muscle cells? Muscle cells make up a muscle, that's true, but it's not just muscle cells. It's epithelium, connective tissue, and neural tissue all in that organ. Are tendons a part of skeletal muscle tissue? The tendons here, is that skeletal muscle? No, it's not skeletal muscle tissue, is it? It's what? It's, name it for me. It's blank connective tissue. Dense regular connective tissue. Good. Dense regular connective tissue. Good. What are bursas? Have you talked about that in gross fat?
Yes.
Good, then we're done with that. How is skeletal muscle the organ held together? By connective tissue. And that's your task in this class. Gross anatomy, pretty simple. Just have to eyeball the muscle, name it, see where it's attached, and find the nerve. Piece of cake. Now, with your microscope, you've got to find the connective tissue, the epithelium, the neural tissue, and the whole ball of wax. Connective tissue found inside and on the surface of the muscle that holds it together has some vocabulary associated with it. And let's work on that vocabulary a little bit here. What we're talking about here is the connective tissue that holds all those muscle cells in a unit so that it can contract. And connective tissue in that muscle is divided into three regions with three names. And let's see if we can make any sense out of these words. Is there anything that you recognize in these three terms that you're familiar with? Which part of those words are you familiar with, some of it? A little louder. Epi means what? Above or on the outside of? How about endo? Deep inside. How about peri? Around. Well, that's not the terms that jumped out at me, really. The term that jumped out at me is myo. What does that mean?
Muscle.
So epi is something on the outside of the muscle. Endo is connective tissue deep inside the muscle. And perimysium somehow is around something. That's the most difficult one, because we don't know right now, you and I, we don't know what it's around. So we have to look at that. And there is a cross-section of the rectus femoris muscle. And the epimysium is dense, irregular connective tissue. Not dense regular, that's tendon. Dense irregular connective tissue. Now that becomes tendon as it covers over the muscle and and spreads from the origin to the insertion on the belly of the muscle. And on the belly of the muscle, it's epimysium. And you learned it as another name in gross anatomy class. When you got to that muscle and you found the shiny, glistening collagen on the surface, it's called what?
Fascia.
Yes, it's called deep fascia. Gross anatomists call it deep fascia. Histologists call it the epimysium. Pathologists also call it the epimysium. It's the outer collagen, shiny, cream-colored, dense, irregular connective tissue on the outside of that muscle. Now, the muscle is divided into compartments, and we'll call those compartments fascicles. Terminology, but fascicles is used a lot. It's not the only time you see that word, fascicles. And let me outline a fascicle for you. Here's one. Here's one. And here's one here. You ever, ignoring the fat in a rib steak or a filet mignon, ignoring the fat, when you look at a cross-section of that piece of meat, you'll notice that the meat is located in bundles. And there's connective tissue that separates these bundles. And in that steak from Outback, sitting there on your plate, you'll see these fascicles. And the connective tissue that separates these fascicles is connective tissue that is found wrapping around the fascicle. So what do you think that this connective tissue wrapping around the fascicle, what should we call it?
Perimysium.
Perimysium. Where are we going to find the endomysium in your muscle? Rectus, femoris, quadriceps, biceps.
Around each muscle cell,
right in here. The endomysium is the loose, areolar connective tissue, some reticular tissue, loose reticular tissue that surrounds each muscle cell. And why do we have this connective tissue called endomysium around every, it's connective tissue, why is it found around every cotton-picking single cell here? I'm drawing some endomysium, and of course I'm not drawing the cell, I'm drawing the endomysium. Here's the cell. Muscle cells have the same diameter from beginning to end. They don't taper into a point. They have exactly the same diameter from beginning to end. And why do we have an endomysium surrounding each one of these muscle cells here in my bicep? Why do we have to have endomysium between the green cell and the blue cell and the red cell? And you can't see it here, obviously. Because we want them to work together, don't we? And we want them to stay together. If there's no endomysium, then... got nothing to connect it. Endomysium is connective tissue. And it connects adjacent muscle cells to one another. When we look at muscle diseases in pathology class, the pathology textbook will say that the immune system is attacking cells in the endomysium. Therefore, blood supply to the muscle cells is lost. Now, if you don't know what endomysium is, then that's just about like reading Greek.
What kind of tissue is the perimysium?
Perimysium is halfway between dense and loose. So most of the time it's considered loose connective tissue. But if you look in the histology slides, you might be convinced that it looks kind of dense. But we're going to call it loose connective tissue. Your author of your textbook makes a good point that sometimes this connective tissue looks halfway in between, half loose and half dense. And that's a good example there. So this muscle that you see after you dissect the leg or the arm, this muscle that you see is held together by three categories of connective tissue. The deep fascia, the epimysium on the outside, the endomysium around every single muscle cell, and then the perimysium, a specialty unit around each separate fascicle.
I was just wondering, what is surrounding the actual fiber itself? Like the muscle fiber, like, you know, there's all the muscle cells.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's we'll do that here before we go. The question is, if we go from this myotube now to a muscle cell, skeletal muscle cell, we find an interesting arrangement where the nuclei in the skeletal muscle cell are pushed way out near the plasma membrane. Lots and lots of nuclei, maybe 50 per millimeter, are pushed along the outside. This is the plasma membrane. It's the phospholipid bilayer. Now your question is, I think, what's around that? Well, it has a basal lamina, like epithelial cell, all the way around it. And I can't really draw that very well, except, and you're not going to see that in a light microscope. Now, here's another one down here. It's PAL next door. Even diameter, nucleus here, nucleus here. Each one of these is a single cell. Each one of them have nuclei and cytoplasm. Each of these cells has a plasma membrane, and each of these cells has a basal lamina. My drawing is incomplete because I can't see in my drawing anything that surrounds that cell. And what surrounds that cell loose connective tissue, so that cell number one and cell number two are connected to one another by collagen fibers. And name that green layer for me up there. It's red. Endomysium. It's around each cell. Here's one cell. Here's one cell here. Here's another cell down here. Here's another cell. And these cells appear in the picture up here. These cells appear right here as these cylinders with plasma membrane on the outside called the sarcolemma, cytoplasm in the interior, and here's the, around here is the endomysium, the connective tissue. Just like my sleeve. Just like my sleeve, here's the endomysium, and here's the muscle cell, one cell. Endomysium holds them together so that they act as a unit. And next time we're gonna see what else is in the endomysium. What do you think has to be in the endomysium here, the connective tissue, in order to keep that cell alive?
Blood
vessels. Right. We're gonna have blood vessels in there. That's perimysium. Yeah, I know that. Perimysium. This is perimysium. That's perimysium. There's one cell. There's two cells. There's two cells. Endomysium is the connective tissue.
It's horrifying, but I
know. So endomysium is here. And then the fibril, myofibril, is a subunit of the cell.
Thank you. That makes sense.
So we're not saying that the fibril is a